Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place in the world at 1-877-876-5227 or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up and can be found on the BBS Radio site or at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows are available now on the station archives. You can read my own blog at http://howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. And now we're going to start with a little update on Ada L. Smith. Now, we've been following the tumultuous adventures of Ms. Smith, state senator for New York, for several weeks now. And it was her violence and her vitriol which brought her to this sort of public attention. And that violence was directed against her own office workers until a grand jury had actually been called. But this week, I have to tell you that it's been postponed. The announcement was made without explanation, and we here are awaiting further events. And that's our update this week on Ada L. Smith. And now, last week, our guest was Chris Cooper, and you'll remember that he spoke on playing games with money. He does a seminar, and in that way, he teaches people how to be empowered and how to understand things like the Fed. So last week, we learned how the Fed really works. We learned that America's economic system abuses our trust on a grand scale. And I know a lot of you were as shocked as I was, but abuse happens retail, too. Being a spiritual politician means examining every part of our lives and making sure we're doing the right thing, living our highest ideals. Now, for Christians, this also means to follow the truth enunciated by Jesus that is so often ignored, and to bring that truth into our own government, because these things should be in alignment. Too many out there use government and power as a way to do the wrong thing, and this places them in moral peril. And I don't think many of us really think about the moral peril that people like George Bush stand in today. When we let people get away with deceit, manipulation, and violence, we're failing to let them experience the truth that Jesus taught. So it's part of our own duty to remind them, first gently and then firmly, what the right thing really is. Now, Jesus was very clear about what we were to do here on earth, and that's to live as he did. Jesus did not run around telling lies for profit. He used persuasion, not manipulation. He urged us to live by our own individual consciences, knowing that each of us has within us, as his gift, the ability to know right from wrong and see the truth. Following his teachings must lead us to consider that tool we use for ordering our lives that we call government. We also need to consider that moral peril that we're putting people in who attach themselves to government for their own profit. And our program tonight takes us into an experience I had that opened my eyes to the nature of those in government and what it can do to those who use it for their own ends. Now, as you probably already know, I'm our guest tonight, and we'll be interviewed about a situation that has taken a good part of my attention for most of the last 7 years. I've been involved in a process of trying to get someone to do the right thing. That person was an old friend of mine who shocked and appalled me by the choices he made. Now, his name is John Fund, and you've probably seen his face on television perhaps more often than you would like. Tonight, I will be interviewed by a man who's been involved in this story for 4 years. Jean Gaudette is the editor of an online magazine called American Political Journal. And his site hosted the story written by John Conley that made the very private events of my life and my daughter's life very public. So tonight I'm turning the mic over to Gene so he can ask me the questions that will help John Fund confront the truth he is still avoiding. Gene, welcome, and thanks for agreeing to do this interview.
Well, you're welcome, Melinda. It's an honor and a pleasure. And hello to everybody listening tonight. I'm Gene Gaudette, the editor of APJ.us, which is the URL for American Politics Journal, which in and of itself has a relatively long history on the Internet. It started when my friend Jeff Coopersmith did a weekly commentary on the political scene in California and the national level. And that started back in 1988. So technically, we are in our 18th year on the Internet or some form thereof.
That's a long time.
It is. It is. Jeff put a lot of work into getting the original website off the ground. We formally went to the web format back in late 1995, early 96, and we now have about 10 years' worth of articles that are currently in the process of being indexed and transformed into our new, tweaked, sweet-looking redesign. That'll take another couple of weeks, but we should have everything up there by then. And before we get to the main subject of tonight's interview,
yes,
I want to congratulate you on your last blog entry at How the Neocons Stole Freedom. I have to say I was grinning ear to ear with your comments on what you title Coulter's War. Ann Coulter acknowledges the covert neocon war on Americans. And this actually plays into the subject at hand, and that is the pension of the neoconservatives to use sort of high-profile hipsters to push their agenda.
Well, I think they actually picked them for that purpose. I think that they actually had a small stable, including several other women, who they were looking to take that particular kind of position. I think it was very intentional.
Well, as I recall, back in the nasty days of the Clinton impeachment, there were two other women who were showing up an awful lot on cable news, particularly on the then-nascent MSNBC network. Ann Coulter was one of them. The other two were Kellyanne Fitzpatrick, who is now married to George T. Conway, who turns out to have been one of the elves trying to push the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And the other one is Laura Ingraham, who's had a rather nasty bout recently with cancer, but seems to be on the mend.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there does seem to be a history, particularly with conservatives, of putting good-looking, approachable, likable, authoritative-sounding spokespersons into place to push their agenda. And a sort of an interesting thing has happened over the last 8 years, if you will, since the Clinton impeachment. Ann always sounded funny and kind of off the wall, and was very novel in a very comic way back in 98. But with book after book after book, she has come across as showing, if you will, the worst side of the neoconservative movement, and coming across in such an angry and bigoted and extreme way that I'm honestly surprised that some of what she says hasn't divided the conservative and neoconservative movement.
Well,
and
it actually has. There are a lot of people who they refuse to take her seriously. That's the comment that I get from people. I refuse to take her seriously. And there's a very strong sense of denial there. They don't understand what she's doing to the Republican Party, because she's pulling people in who view politics as simply a way of getting the goodies. And that didn't used to be the case. The people that you would run into, there would be some of those kinds of people, but they were very much the minority. And she's just changing the culture internally for the Republican Party, which is a frightening thing on top of everything else. And I don't know if they anticipated that, but they very well might have. But I have to correct you on one thing. The Republican men don't tend to be attractive. The Republican pundits don't tend to be attractive. It's only the women that they know need to be attractive. And there's a reason for that. If you have a Republican woman who's attractive saying things like that, the fact is, and you're going to maybe cringe about what liberal men do, they refuse to confront. Very few of them will call her on what she says.
they tend to call her not directly to her face, but I do see an awful lot of commentary on her more extreme comments on liberal and even to the even in this day and age conservative blogs who have gotten kind of fed up with her whole song and dance.
But they have to do it to their face.
You don't see it happen, though. You're absolutely right about that. And
the only person who has is actually Dan Borscher.
Hmm. Yes, and in fact, you mention him if I'm not mistaken in the blog entry. The thing that most troubles me though is that I get the feeling that many of the producers, many of the string pullers at the cable news networks won't allow a confrontation like that to happen because Ann Coulter, let's face it, like a good train wreck, like a good auto accident, is good for ratings. And they don't want to do anything that might jeopardize what little credibility she has, or for that matter, what entertainment value she has. They don't want somebody debunking her. And I think that it does play into the infotainment nature of news and the way that it's transformed in the last 10 years, with both Fox and MSNBC jumping into the fray, and in many ways kind of kicking the news out of the news.
Well, I think that's true to some extent, but in another way too, she's treated the way she is because people, you know, they sort of know that she was carrying the neocon agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about the change that there has been since like 2001, in terms of the way that these people are viewed. I mean, there was a period of time where they just simply owned the world.
Mm-hmm.
They had so much power, so much influence, and they were just untouchable.
Mm. That's true. That is true. You've got a very strong point there. I'd also point out that given who owns the networks and given who sponsors many of the programs that are designed to shape opinion, many of them have to, if you will, get in bed with the neoconservatives in order to do good business. Whether you're talking General Electric or many of the larger pharmaceutical corporations, they are very much in the debt of the pundits who run, if you will, a parallel set of opinion shaping and opinion dynamics goals. I even remember it from the days of when McLaughlin, John McLaughlin, the McLaughlin Group,
mm-hmm.
were becoming a very right-wing alternative to Agronsky. And, of course, it was very notable that McLaughlin has latched on to sponsors who are in telecommunications, defense industry, agribusiness, and the pharmaceutical industry. And when you look at the roster of guest pundits that he pulls on, that he calls on, you'll see that the ones who are more authoritative, naturally you have Tony Blankley with the Washington Times, but among the people who get rotated in are you know, Mort Zuckerman and Byron York and John Funt. And there has been, I think, as you pointed out with the women, a strong effort to get authoritative voices in the media over the last two decades, particularly, in order to push the agenda of neoconservatism and the modern, if you will, 21st century push to democratize the world, which is not exactly working out the way they want it to. So,
well, that's certainly true.
Well, which brings us to the subject of tonight's interview. And one of the most notable neoconservative pundits at the Wall Street Journal and on television is John Fund. And I can remember when I first started taking the Washington-based opinion shows seriously, Fund was ubiquitous. He came across as well-informed, very, very able to shape the message, but it was also clear to me almost from the beginning that he'd been given marching orders and talking points by any number of think tanks, whether it was the Heritage Foundation, the Manhattan Institute, or his friends in the Republican Party. Yet he always seemed to have an ability to convey those points clearly by either sneaking them in one answer or just spitting out factoids in the sort of 25 words or less declamatory style that seems to be basically a basic building block of getting the message across in the media. And of course, that was at a time when you knew John very well. And I'm curious, well, let's go right back to the beginning. How did you first meet John?
I met John in San Diego at a Libertarian convention. I was Southern California vice chairman, and mm-hmm. he had just been picked, sort of to my surprise, as executive director for the Libertarian Party of California, I believe displacing Eric Garris.
Wow, what year was that?
And this would have been, I think, 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it surprised me was because Eric had been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was a fairly well-respected activist. And I found out, actually, one of the articles that brought this all up was, of course, the one written by Justin Raimondo that was in mm-hmm. antiwar.com. And it went into some of the things that had happened with John Fund, his pretending to have run for office up there, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the other things that that I'd realized through the same period of time was that there was a power play going on within the Libertarian Party that most people weren't aware of at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the takeover of the Libertarian Party by Ed Crane, the Coke machine, Coke Industries.
Yes. That's K-O-C-H for all of you listeners out there.
K-O-C-H, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So that they could actually use it as a means of manufacturing a different kind of policy than had ever been the intention. And I found out that John was always very much part of that process. They wanted to get rid of Eric Garris because he was affiliated with the Radical Caucus group and
mm-hmm.
the people that were grouped around Rothbard, who they bumped off of the Cato board in 1981, even though he'd been a founder.
Well, what were the basic agenda points that were taking over, if you will, and which ones were being swept under the rug?
The Libertarian Party started as a way to work for human liberty, mm-hmm. you know, complete, absolute
right.
human liberty. The Koch Industries has a long history of cooperation with government. They're in Iraq now. They were in Vietnam as contractors.
Mm-hmm.
They do contracting all over. Their reputation isn't good that way.
Mm-hmm.
They get definitely treated as sort of preferred players.
So in other words, there was an effort by Koch and their operatives to substitute an agenda of, if you will, corporate libertarianism and shut down individual libertarianism.
See very clearly what happened in the movement after that point, because they poured the money into to Cato.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other things simply sort of quietly died. And this actually also, you know, covers the period of time when, I don't know if you're aware of the work of Murray Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises, but they were Austrian economists.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't approve of the use of law to create economic policy. That's
mm-hmm.
one of the, you know, the sort of foundational points about Austrian economics. That's not what you do. They
right.
will tell you, if you do this, you're going to get this, and it's going to be a bad outcome. But if you take a look at Milton Friedman, who that was then picked up, he does use policy. He does use law.
So back then, there was an effort to get rid of, if you will, the freedom movement and put in the free market movement. And when you first met John seemed to be very openly pushing for...
He didn't say a word about it. Let me tell you, one of the things that they always did...
How did he do it?
What he did was displace Eric Garris in the North, because
mm-hmm.
Garris wasn't a reliable Crane person. He wasn't going to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they got rid of him. And then, not long after that, I found out he actually got a Sabre Foundation grant and went back to D.C., where he
mm-hmm.
almost immediately went to work for Evans and Novak.
Right, and I remember reading from in a couple of sources that he was pretty close to Bob Novak during the mid-80s. What can you tell me about that relationship and any insight you might have into what was going on?
My understanding was always that they talked a lot,
mm-hmm.
that they were, you know, that he had been mentored by Novak, and then that Novak was the one that helped place him at the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
When I say place him at the Wall Street Journal, What I personally think is that he was placed there to be exactly what he functioned as a political operative.
I think that that may very well be a pretty accurate assessment when you look at his writing, and he's an incredibly lucid writer. He makes his points very clearly. He spells them out very well. He's actually a very good writer, which is, I believe, the main reason that Rush Limbaugh got him to ghostwrite Limbaugh's first book. But he has an exceptional talent for putting together arguments and making his point very carefully and very methodically and either conveying it or pulling it over, if you will, on the reader. The interesting function, though, at the Wall Street Journal is that there seems to be almost a Chinese wall between their news division and their opinion page. And their opinion page, of course, is very pro-corporate America. And is it your impression that one of the reasons he was placed there was to put the neoconservative message in sync with what was going on in corporate America, or do you think that there was something above and beyond that?
Well, I think the neoconservative message is corporate America. I mean, I think that's why they were hired, so to speak, because
mm-hmm.
they had to be put in place by somebody. And I think that that's exactly what happened. They saw what they needed to do. I mean, to go back and take a look what happened with Rove
mm-hmm.
and Abramoff and Reed when they divvied up the Republican Party in the early 70s when they were all young Republicans figuring out how they were going to do it. They knew they had to do a build-out. The build-out had to include people to take particular roles. And they either found people and sort of reformatted them and directed them, or they did kind of talent searches like we pointed out with Ann Coulter and the two other women. Because they knew they needed somebody like that to replace Phyllis Schlafly.
Who is not exactly the most attractive or, for that matter, marketable message carrier for the conservative movement.
But she rose back when she was doing her job.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, because the thing that she did is she stopped the passage of the ERA by doing what? How did she do it? She told a whole series of lies about it. And people still believe that. Every day that I talk to libertarians or conservatives, I encounter people who believe that we're all going to have to use the same bathroom if the ERA is passed.
I remember that one, and I thought that's just about the most ridiculous thing I had ever heard. It made no sense to me, and it still makes no sense to me, that people, on the one hand, don't have the common sense to say, this is the biggest pile of hooey I've ever heard. On the other hand, when it comes from somebody who seems to be in a position of authority, you can carry it off. But it's not as if John Fund was, just immediately placed there and was immediately the voice of authority. There seemed to be a number of years where he was writing and making appearances, and of course, it takes a while to gain that kind of credibility. And over the last 20 years, he seems to be one of the most trusted and credible voices on the right.
Yeah, you remember, this man is still briefed by the White House on a regular basis.
As
he
has admitted himself, yes. I'm just curious that in the early years when you knew him and when you were close to him, if you'll excuse me getting a little bit into the personal side of this and almost sounding like Larry King, when did you finally fall in love with him, and what did he tell you and what didn't he tell you?
The thing about John is that I could actually have an intelligent conversation with him. And, regrettably, there weren't a lot of people that I could have an intelligent conversation with. He actually knew a lot about a lot of different subjects, which was interesting. And he had different views on them than the other people in the movement that I had encountered. Also, he just sort of pursued me, which I thought kind of odd because I knew he was younger than I was. And I'm sort of, conservative that way.
Yes, but he was the one who was the amorous pursuer, and you were, if you will, the pursued. How did that make you feel, and
also being sort of like a little puppy dog, He was kind of cute when he was younger.
Yeah.
And I thought it was sort of sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were, from the beginning, there were things that kind of, I thought were kind of odd about him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you sort of accept. I mean, we were in a movement where people accepted that people did things that were different, and they just mm-hmm. did that, and you weren't supposed to be judgmental about it. And, you know, honestly, since he lived up north and I lived down south, I didn't see that much of him. It was mostly on the telephone.
Wow.
But we'd have long conversations on the telephone.
Long-distance relationship, but I can kind of guess that above and beyond the personal things you talk about issues that you were both interested in and what he was doing and what he had done and what he wanted to do.
Well, yes, and actually, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that because I didn't think about that till this afternoon. But
mm-hmm.
he actually mentioned that supposed school board race that he ran to me.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, but then he got this funny look on his face, and he just said, well, you know, it wasn't really anything to talk about. And, of course, now I realize I did not know, and one of the people who called me up who knew him intimately up there, who's a good
mm-hmm.
friend of his, also did not know that he hadn't actually run, that he had never filed for that race, so he went every week to a meeting and reported his progress for months.
Well, so he was basically pulling the wool over your eyes and the eyes of others.
Yes, and now one of the things that you're going to have to notice as a failing of the Libertarian Party is they went ahead and hired him as executive director anyway. Though I would have to say probably the only people who knew were, ironically enough, Eric Garris and, you know, perhaps a couple people around him in the Radical Caucus. Because evidently Eric didn't tell anybody. He certainly didn't tell me. And I certainly knew Eric at the time.
Wow, that's a pretty devastating little factoid. Was there anything else that he was fudging or hiding or not being completely honest with you about?
Well, I was very surprised. After I wrote the response article to Raimondo's article in antiwar.com, I was contacted by a gentleman who actually was one of the people who sat at the table and helped John fill out the grant request to the Sabre Institute that took him to the East Coast. But the things he told me about John really surprised me because I hadn't had a hint. Evidently, one of the things that John did is there were situations that arose where you'd have a libertarian running in a race up there, and he was obviously going to hold the balance of power between the Republican and Democrat. So the Republicans paid money to get a quiescent race, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's completely illegal. But the person who was who took the money was John, not the candidate.
Well.
And he used it. And it's funny how these things come out, because at one point we were chatting, we were having a conversation on the phone, and I was considering leaving the this is fairly late in the relationship, and I was considering leaving the Libertarian Party. He said, well, and re-registering Republican. And he said, well, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter what you register. They never check, and I'm registered several different ways.
Several different ways?
Yes. Now, actually, the same gentleman who helped him fill out the grant request for the Sabre Foundation said that he had never actually been registered Libertarian at all. He had checked.
Whoa.
Which I thought was very interesting, too. But, you know, you go through this process getting to know somebody. Like, a friend of mine went up to Sacramento for some meeting, and John was there, and, you know, we saw him, and he took us around the Capitol, and he told us he was a legislative assistant. Now, afterwards, I had this conversation with the gentleman who contacted me after the article had been written, and he told me that John had never been a legislative assistant. And I was very surprised. I said, well, but he took us around the Capitol like he was.
How was he able to do that? Was he just inflating his resume and also cultivating contacts in Sacramento?
Evidently, yes. And this actually then reminded me of another curious incident that took
mm-hmm.
place about the same time. My brother, Charles Arthur Pillsbury, actually was a legislative assistant in Sacramento at exactly this time. He was working as a legislative assistant at the same time he was finishing law school at Davis and flying part-time in the National Guard because He was a veteran. He had been decorated in Vietnam. And John contacted my brother, and my brother was completely freaked out. And, you know, my understanding was that, John was asking my brother to help him get a job, which I thought was kind of odd, too.
Well, this is a person who's supposed to be a big player in a nascent political party that is growing in California, and he's looking for a job.
Well, this is before he had any of that. This while he's still in Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
I think he actually was executive director, but they say they never paid him when he was executive director.
Ah.
I mean, the Libertarian Party was like that. Mm-hmm. They would decide that they were going to do something, and they wouldn't bother to decide that they could actually raise the money to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons I always did my own fundraising in the South, which is why I oftentimes didn't know what was going on in the North, because this is where that sort of thing happened.
Mm-hmm. And this was, as you were saying, around the time that the relationship was beginning to wind down.
Was actually at the beginning, 82.
It was at the beginning of the relationship.
It was before John went to D.C.
Uh-huh.
Or New York. First he was in D.C. and then he was in New York.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did the relationship begin to come apart? What happened?
Well, I dumped him. I dumped him like three times because I was very put off by about finding out that he had approached my brother like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that he actually got as far as asking him to help him find a job, but my brother's attitude, I was so embarrassed I didn't even want to pursue it. But we went through a period where we didn't talk there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I started seeing him and talking to him again. And I don't think he had a car of his own, because when he would come and see me, he would take the bus down and I'd pick him up at the bus station.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on a couple of, I think it was on that occasion that he met my children, who were then,
wow,
you know, little kids.
Mm-hmm. And these are two children, right?
No, there were four of them by then.
Four of them by then. And so he knew them when they were basically little kids.
Yes. The Rugrat stage.
Indeed, yes, when they're, yes, the terrible twos and a little bit beyond that.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So after it wound down, you went your separate ways. So, fill in the, if you will, the period between, you know, when you finally split for the third and last time and when he came back into your life, and a little bit of background about what you were up to and what direction your life was taking.
Well, I sort of broke up. I was getting married.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was not there much. We'd talk on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
But he was living on the East Coast by that time. I wasn't seeing him. I was dating somebody else. I got married. I called him up and told him that I was getting married. That this made no difference in our phone conversations, really.
Wow.
Because he kept calling me up and talking on the telephone.
So there was a lot of political wonk speak and ideas, and it was as if, was it as if the relationship didn't matter at all, that he was more interested in throwing around ideas and getting your opinions and sharing his opinions?
Well, there could have been some of that. I know I wasn't as interested in him that way as I was in the conversations.
Hmm.
Because by that time, of course, he was having some more interesting things to say, too, because he was meeting people on the East Coast that were interesting.
And he was also becoming, at that time, a bit of a media figure. Television was starting to play more of a role in his career, wasn't it?
It was, usually what I would do is I'd read something that he had written in the Wall Street Journal. Because, I took the Wall Street Journal, and I would, you know, I could always tell when it was he that had written it.
Mm-hmm. Even on the editorial page, you could
right,
just sniff out his style immediately.
Yes, I could. And then when you're moving into, like, the early 90s, then at that point, my youngest daughter, because I had the three girls first, was going to Hillsdale. And she mm-hmm. had actually decided to go to Hillsdale in large part because of the nice things that John Fund had said about Hillsdale.
Wow. And that's Ayn, right?
That's Ayn.
Mm-hmm.
And Ayn was actually also accepted at Mount Holyoke and Syracuse and Northeastern, But she went to Hillsdale because we were told it was a marvelous college that put issues like the First Amendment first. And, you know, it was simply dedicated to the ideas of freedom.
And back then it wasn't so well known that it was a very strong school and a magnet school for people in the conservative and the libertarian and the smaller government movements. This is something that wasn't really well known to the public, but certainly Hillsdale and at the graduate level Pepperdine and even at the undergraduate level University of Chicago were looked at as and Carleton College were looked at as really solid places to go if you wanted not just to go to a good school but to become involved in a more conservative or small government kind of movement. And
yes, and that's why she went there.
Mm-hmm. And then
she was actually, I think this is her junior year, I got this horrified telephone call that there were two students who had been doing an alternative paper and they were expelled for doing it.
Well.
There was a series of different things that happened. I had been going to the parents' meetings, flying back there to go to the Hillsdale parents' meetings and meeting people. And I had also gotten we were living in Santa Barbara. I'd gotten a telephone call from somebody at Hillsdale asking me to make some, make some telephone calls because they were going to be doing an event. And I said, okay, well, I guess they're going to do a fundraiser. That's fine. That's the sort of thing you do to support a small school like this. I can be up for that. So I told them to send me the names. They sent me seven names. Now, you've been in politics and I've been in politics. They sent me seven names. I mean, what was this about? That wasn't very much. And the event was going to be at the Biltmore in Montecito.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it and I said, well, this is going to be kind of interesting. I wonder, you know, how they're going to pay for the event and what the fundraiser is going to be like. So I went, and it was George Roche there with his whole little crew. And there was a beautiful buffet. The place was lavishly decorated. And they asked several of us, I think there were maybe six or eight of us, to stand. And we got a round of applause because we'd made, and I knew I'd made seven phone calls, so I was very embarrassed. But, of course, then afterwards they wanted to hit us up for large amounts of money. But the whole way that they did fundraising at Hillsdale I thought was completely appalling. Because it was very much focused on getting the big money in there,
mm-hmm.
and then the money would disappear, and you wouldn't really find out what happened to it. Because one of the other things that I noticed as I was going back to the parents' meetings was that things like the professors didn't have assistants. You could
no
see
teaching.
That the money wasn't going into the plant, into teaching. And I didn't think that was appropriate at all. And nobody's ever been able to find out, because it's a private institution, where the money went. But it's supposed to be one of the best endowed colleges in the world now.
Yet at that time, the teachers, they couldn't afford to find the teachers' assistants to do little things like grading papers and making sure things were running smoothly.
I don't know that if they couldn't afford it or they didn't want to afford it. Evidently, Roche got an incredibly lucrative retirement package after he had to retire when his daughter-in-law, who he had been having an affair with, shot herself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that.
Oh yes, that was a bit of a scandal. That even managed to make a number of the national papers, and it was also, and this is something that even kind of turned my stomach. It almost seemed like a slam of the conservative movement. This was a very personal tragedy for that family, for the Roche family. And yet it was glommed down to by an awful lot of people on the left as in a sort of a snarky way that I found myself a little bit distasteful. And it was, you know, everybody has their human failings, yet the school took a real black eye for that, I think, rather unfairly. It's going to surprise a lot of people who read American Politics Journal to hear me say that, but it is a very conservative school, and my own ideology is not exactly in line with Hillsdale, but it's one thing to have real, honest, and respectable disagreements on philosophy. It's another thing to let a personal tragedy get used. And I found it rather ironic that some on the left were doing the very sort of thing that John Fund tends to do on the right in terms of character assassination, and going after targets on a very personal and very vindictive level.
Well, I didn't think they should have done what they did to Lisa's family. That
mm-hmm.
was her name. Her name was Lisa Roche.
Right.
But I was appalled that there wasn't more transparency, that they didn't come forward and say, look, because the issue was raised at the time, this is what's been done with the money. I wanted to know what had happened with the endowment and how it was being used.
Exactly, and the scandal turned out to be a very personal scandal rather than, you know, serious and, I think, very, very honest questions about where did the money go? You know, show us where the money is being used and where the endowment fund is being invested and what comes out and where it pays. That's a much more serious scandal, both academic and business scandal, than the very personal scandal of the suicide.
Well, yes, and I thought that's what should be talked about. As a matter of fact, this is another thing that, you know, kind of started to corrode my trust in John politically, because I had contacted him when these two students had been expelled,
mm-hmm.
and I had contacted him when a couple other questionable events had taken place at the school, and he simply blew me off. And it was in that period of time I realized, he mentioned he was going to be speaking there. He didn't tell me how much the honorarium was, but he gave me to understand it was extremely significant, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go take a look at who speaks there, they were obviously being paid a lot of money. And of course, then I was comparing that to the fact that they didn't seem to have money to pay the teaching assistants.
Wow.
And I thought, this doesn't look right to me.
Yeah, it kind of smells bad when the people who are doing the teaching, who are building the minds, if you will, are not given what they need. But they're able to plump for guest speakers and treat them like royalty. That's
right. And then I continued to have the conversations with John.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I really started noticing that he would call me up and tell me something that he obviously wanted me to start spreading. And I realized I was being used as a sort of a leak.
Mm-hmm.
So he called me up and told me the story about Clinton's black love child.
Oh, yes, the famous... love child that even Matt Drudge got suckered into writing about.
That one. Then
yeah.
There was with the Paula Jones. There was the tattoo on the presidential genitals.
Yes, and other similar tall tales. Were you on the receiving end of any rumors about Sidney Blumenthal?
Yes, I was.
Well.
But you see, it wasn't a rumor because. By that point, what had happened is he had started his relationship with my daughter, and so I didn't hear this directly from John. I heard it from Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
That remember when Blumenthal settled the lawsuit?
Yes.
John called Morgan up drunk as a skunk,
mm-hmm.
Gloating. And I think that would be when she found out that he and Drudge had actually invented the whole thing from the beginning.
Here we're going to have to take a little bit of a chronological step backward for the sake of the listeners, so they know exactly who the players are. Morgan is, of course, your daughter.
Yes, my oldest daughter.
And when did you get wind that she was in a relationship with your former boyfriend?
Well, my other daughter called me, Ayn called me, and said that Morgan had told her this, but that she didn't think it was credible, and this would have been early in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And never being one to be backward about this, Morgan and I weren't talking at the time for various reasons, I called John directly and asked him, and he said no. He was just feeding her cat for her, so that's where the feeding the cat remark came from. And so several months later when Morgan got in touch with me, I didn't believe her because I had been told by John, who, even though I didn't agree with him politically, I believed to be an honorable person.
And he said, no, it's I'm just feeding her cat.
Just feeding her cat. Now, I wouldn't do something like that. That would be horrible, blah, 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 blah. And he told me he was in a relationship with somebody, and he went into actually a rather lot of detail about it. And you know, I thought it was about time he was in a relationship. I mean, he was getting kind of long in the tooth, right, as we all were.
Mm-hmm. Losing a little hair, gaining a little spare tire. I know that routine pretty well.
Well, we all do because we age, and, you know, generally the time you get into a relationship is when you're younger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that turned out not to be the case. Shortly after that, didn't you find out that the relationship had actually been going on for nearly a year?
Yes. Morgan and I were having a conversation about this. Mm-hmm. I wasn't believing her. She wanted me to believe her, and her call waiting went off. And she put me on hold, and I waited and waited and waited and waited and waited, and I finally hung up and called back and getting the call waiting thing myself. And then finally I hung up, and she called me back, and she said, "Just listen." And she went click, and she played the conversation that was up on the Weasel Search tape.
Oh, my goodness. This is...
And I could not believe it.
Okay, we're going to have to tell people who aren't familiar with the whole story what the Weasel Search tape is. But as I recall, you told me that they had actually met at a conference in New York.
They met at an Objectivist conference in New York the year before, 98.
And that's where the whole thing had started. They started seeing each other at that point.
That's right.
Wow.
And they were talking, and at that point, evidently, Morgan believed that they were going to get married.
Mm-hmm. And Morgan also told you that she had gotten pregnant, hadn't she?
Yes. I mean, mm-hmm. She told me everything, and I believed John and not her. And then when I heard the tape, of course, I had to reverse that because it was very clear he lied.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to have to reference this for listeners who aren't familiar with the whole story. The tape to which Melinda refers is available on the American Politics Journal website, apj.us. It is referred to as the Weasel Search tape, and can you tell us a little bit of the background about how it got that now legendary nickname?
Yes. Morgan called, evidently got in touch with John Conley. She and John had a falling out. She had some interviews with him and shared the tape. And this was, you know, the early summer of 2001. Soon after that, she and John made up and moved in together with the expectation that they were going to be getting married. Mm-hmm. And John... was trying to sell. John had written the story for Talk Magazine, and
mm-hmm.
he actually called me up, and I confirmed what I did, but I didn't want to, what I could, but I wasn't going to talk anything anymore about it because I thought it was inappropriate that Morgan had discussed it with him. Actually,
just for the sake of the listeners, we've got two Johns in the mix now. Here we've got John Fund and a gentleman named John Connolly, who used to write for Spy Magazine in the early 1990s. Was a writer for Talk Magazine at the time in 1998 and was one of the writers for the short-lived Radar Magazine, which was combining celebrity and political gossip.
Mm-hmm.
Connolly is an investigative reporter, and also on the American Politics Journal website is John Connolly's brilliant article on Wackenhut, which in many ways is very prescient about things that are going on in the intelligence arena in this country now, because at the time when he was writing about Wackenhut, he essentially argued that it was a privatized version of an intelligence organization.
Mm-hmm.
And Connolly is one of the smartest and most articulate and readable investigative journalists out there.
Quite a job on John, I have to say.
Absolutely. And the Weasel Search tape, of course, was originally on the Weasel Search website, but you can read John Fund's Sex, Lies, and the Tapes at American Politics Journal, apj.us, and it is linkable on our homepage.
Mm-hmm, yes, it's definitely still there,
mm-hmm.
And John is still there, and one of the things that I got about John, and these are things that, you know, they'd been building up over a long time, is that he had made a career on lies.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that happened in Sacramento with pretending to be a candidate, but
right.
actually not being the candidate at all, he was living out another person's, you know, campaign who was the candidate. He'd
mm-hmm.
done this other times, and other people who had known him intimately had seen exactly the same thing. And then I heard from a gentleman who was working at Reason Foundation that they had stopped sending him articles to look at that people had written because he would steal them.
Whoa.
And, you know, when I started looking at this, I felt tremendous concern because here my daughter was involved with this guy.
And you were seeing a pattern of a man who
deceptive behavior and very strange emotional behavior.
But in many ways,
it played its way out when they got together and I found out he was battering her.
Now, that was, in many ways, one of the most inflammatory aspects of the story. It created, of course, an absolute firestorm on political discussion boards back when the story first broke. Naturally, his defenders were saying it's lies, it's all lies, it's damn lies. And his detractors, many of whom had only read about it on the Internet or through some of the articles that were written in the Village Voice and even some of the gossip columns in the New York tabloids, were saying, yeah, I can buy it. I never trusted the guy. He's a professional liar and a spinmeister. But what you're bringing to this whole story is a whole different angle, that you've seen a history of dissembling and obfuscation and just making stuff up out of thin air.
Yeah, and beyond that, the Wall Street Journal knew perfectly well what he was about. This guy is a political operative. He's
mm-hmm.
working for the neocons at the Wall Street Journal. He's an independent operative. He isn't even somebody who's sort of in-house, so he has a much greater degree of trust than, say, somebody would be who was officially in the administration.
Do you think that that played a factor in his having been shifted aside to opinionjournal.com, which is the Wall Street Journal's
online? He had to go in the barrel
presence
for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what had happened.
If he'd been an in-house full-time Dow Jones employee, you think he would have been out the door?
I think he would have been, because the fact is, he knows too much. He knows where the bodies are buried, and he's the one that undertook the campaign against the Clinton White House
mm-hmm.
for the Wall Street Journal. Imagine if he ever decided to write a book about that.
In your conversations with him concerning the whole period of the Clinton scandals, the Monica Lewinsky scandal, the Paula Jones thing, what exactly did he say to you about what was going on at the Journal? Did he take credit for being the mastermind of everything that was going on the op-ed page?
Not on the op-ed page, but the attacks on the White House, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There
was almost an obsessive thing about that that after a while I couldn't help but notice.
That it wasn't so much politics as a very personal thing for him, almost something that he was trying to take credit for achieving, trying to get rid of Bill Clinton. I got rid of a president. Is that the impression you got from him?
And I wouldn't say that necessarily. I would say that that was just something that he really, really seemed to want to do. He was, he was like demonizing him. And I'm not saying that I was any particular fan of Bill Clinton's, because I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't matter. I mean, there's the truth, and you don't lie about people.
That's what
this whole thing is about. John Scott has never confronted the fact that he's a liar, and he uses more lies and more lies and more lies to try to smooth it over and get his way, which is one of the things I had to encounter because people contacted me. It was very clear that he had contacted them and told them I was a liar.
Mm-hmm. But isn't you have to, wouldn't you have to say that that's almost a part of our political culture these days, that there is no more honesty in politics?
And that's exactly what we as Americans need to focus on. That's what we need to see. That we cannot let politics be war between us. We cannot let ourselves be divided this way anymore. Because what we do when we allow this to happen, we enable the worst aspects of human nature to come to the forefront.
In other words, victory by any means is defeat.
Is defeat for honor and liberty.
And for everybody, not just the so-called victors, but for those on the other side of the political fence.
John is killing himself morally this way. He really is. He needs to be confronted with what he did.
But there's never been an intervention. Nobody has ever, no group of his friends have ever gotten together, to your knowledge, to say, John, you've got to stop this. You've got to get your act together.
No, they haven't. And they should. They really should. That's what I was trying to do. But, of course, he tried to characterize it as something else. Because it isn't like I didn't care about him as a human being. You care about people. You want to make sure that, you know, that they see what they're doing and they understand so they can make amends.
Immediately after the scandal over over John Fund's relationship with your daughter had gotten into the media, and it wasn't exactly, let's say, the kind of thing that you'd see reported on Entertainment Tonight, but certainly in the areas of political junkies, politicians, political professionals, and even media professionals, it was talked about for months, and Fund was off the radar in terms of media appearances, television appearances.
Didn't he?
Yes, but with that having happened, are you surprised that you haven't heard that anybody tried to basically sit him down, or a group of his friends tried to sit him down?
No, because his friends were mostly neocons, I think, and the ones that were decent were worried about him. There was a very good friend of his that I talked to that knew him in Sacramento who was concerned about him, but there were other friends that just simply refused to talk to him again, and I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he has a lot of thinking to do about who he is and what he is and what he needs to do with the rest of his life. Because power doesn't matter; doing the right thing matters. That lasts.
Now, to sort of wrap this up and bring it full circle, at one point, if I'm not mistaken, there was talk circulating that he had told you that he was going to go on a spiritual retreat.
No, he told me he was going to go write the book that he wrote as a, you know, to excuse the ballot theft.
Ah, right. His famous.
Yeah,
his
he
famous
was going to write one about ballot fraud, and it wasn't until later I said, "Oh, now I understand."
Yes, it wasn't exactly the kind of ballot fraud that, say, Brad Friedman or a number of other investigative bloggers and websites have gotten into. His whole approach to the election theft was, oh, the Democrats are behind it, they're doing it.
And it's just like Coulter now. Oh, it's the Democrats.
And there seems to be a scarcity of information in that book on the effect that electronic voting machines and computerized voting machines are having on the issue of ballot fraud, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yes. And, you know, I recommend everybody take a look at that book, but try not to have to buy it.
Right. Well, it's available at your local Barnes & Noble.
I'm sure it's also available at your local used bookstore.
Right, or your local public library.
Yes, get it there.
But that seems to be shaping up as a very big issue this year, and finally,
the
press, in little dribs and drabs, is starting to pay attention to the problem of computerized voting as opposed to old-fashioned electioneering and ballot rigging.
We should probably close before my engineer gets mad at me.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm going to turn it back to you. It was a pleasure having you on your own show, Melinda.
Well, thank you, Gene. You've been fantastic, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, you're a wonderful interviewee, and thank you for sharing your opinions, not just on your former boyfriend, but how it touches on a huge number of subjects. And
yes, we've covered
it all. If anything, it says to me, and I'll say this in conclusion, my biggest observation is that the personal life of somebody who has this much power in the media, touching on so many aspects of personal lives and issues, should be a lesson to our listeners in the power that media players can have and perhaps should not have.
Amen.
You take care, and it was great talking with you.
Thank you, Gene.
You're welcome, Linda.
When we know, when we have the truth, we're armed to take action for ourselves and for the betterment of everyone. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free, even John Fund. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. May God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.